Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 307. We're recording on Thursday, April 11th, 2019. I'm Rebecca Shinsky. I'm here with Jeff O'Neill. We're coming to you from BookRiot.com.
That was a nice improvisation there.
The
date was wrong.
And you like that?
The header. That's enough to throw off my whole day if I hit that. That's a speed, but this jalopy just falls apart on it.
I am like fueled by sunshine and possibly a hibiscus hard lemonade. So I'm doing all right today.
Riddle me this, Batgirl. Is hibiscus in like drinks that you can buy off the shelf? That's new, right? Is that the acai berry of like the late 20 teens here? Because I feel like I'm seeing hibiscus everywhere.
I feel like it's having a moment, but it's not totally new. Like there's a hibiscus tea that I've consumed for several years, but I do think it's having a like it's hitting some sort of threshold where I had like a hibiscus kombucha recently because I'm a hippie and there are hibiscus. I just had that hibiscus hard lemonade. I think I had a hibiscus infused beer at some point. Yeah, it does seem like there's a thing. Maybe it's crossing over some it's having a moment
on an infinite timeline. Every scent that's in your bath room will eventually become something you drink in hard alcohol. That's just inevitable. It's all going to be there in the fullness of time.
I did have a moment last year where I was making lavender lemonade.
Yeah, and lavender, great example.
Right. Yeah, like there's a huge lavender bush in my yard. What am I going to do with it? There's a Thug Kitchen recipe for lavender lemonade. So I'm making that. And then later on running a bubble bath also with lavender. And I was like, something about this does not feel totally right.
It is. You know how like, was it the color company Pantone? They do the color of the year every year. Mm-hmm. I feel like maybe I'm sure someone in New Jersey does this, like the flavor, like what's this year's flavor to watch? And I'm sure it actually would lead sort of what they're putting into lattes at Starbucks or whatever, because that feels a little bit behind. But like,
I feel like
where are we headed towards? The flavor of the year, like you're saying, like 2 years ago would have been hibiscus, and now it's trickling down into other things.
I've been seeing juniper lattes. I don't know
disgusting.
About that.
I 100%
agree.
Gin has never been my drink of choice.
Yeah, I'm not going to try a juniper latte. I feel like I don't need to know that I wouldn't like it, but I've been seeing that. But it does feel like there's this real thing happening right now of like, what botanical could we infuse this item with?
That's even worse than like bathroom botanicals. Now we're to like cleaning product botanicals. Like that's Pine Sol. I'm not drinking that. Like we don't need 409 lattes. We don't need any of that stuff.
409 lattes. Welcome to a podcast about books and reading.
Yeah, marinated in WD-40. None of this is okay. Anyway, so hibiscus is matcha's had its moment. We're past that. That's just part of the culture now. Like things are green tea flavored, which is fascinating to me. I'm trying. I wish I could remember like what were the flavors like in the 90s when we were growing, when we were in high. Like what were
nothing was natural. It was like clear Pepsi.
Well, that's true. That it was like Franken sodas. Like you could put you just put cherry syrup in everything. What could you make cherry quote unquote cherry flavored? Yeah, that's a good point.
I was telling you just before we started the show that I just finished watching Pen 15 on Hulu, which is set in 2000 in a middle school. And there's a scene where two kids are practicing in the band room after school. And one of them is drinking a Surge. And I was like, oh, right.
Yeah, Surge.
Like he's wearing JNCOs and drinking a Surge. Oh, and it was such a moment.
That is something else. Anyway, let's get to the show. We could do this all day. Our first sponsor this week is the Center of the Universe. Not the actual Center of the Universe. It's a book called The Center of the Universe, in case people were confused, by Rhea Voros. Here's the deal. So the main character is a budding astronomer, astrophysicist, this is a good sponsor today. We got pictures of black holes now. Very exciting. It's a huge fan of real-life astrophysicist Dr. Elizabeth Tasker, who makes a cameo in the book playing herself. Dr. Tasker is delighted about this and read and approved the manuscript after being approached by Rita. There's even a Q&A with Tasker at the end of the novel. Dr. Tasker is a world-renowned astrophysicist and science communicator and currently lives in Japan, where she works for the Japan Aerospace Explorations Agency, JAXA, J-A-X-A, the Institute of Space and Astronautical Sciences, researching computer models to explore the formation of planets and galaxies. She herself also has a book called The Planet Factory. So you get a little bit like inception of the real world into this book about a kid who wants to be an astrophysicist with a real life person that's in the book. I don't know. It's kind of mind bending. I like it. It seems like appropriate for a book about astrophysics, which it's like, if you ever want to get high without actually taking anything, just think about just go to one of those planetariums and watch a thing about the origin of the universe. And you'll feel like, you've ingested something that maybe was a Schedule II narcotic 10 years ago. Anyway, that is The Center of the Universe by Ria Voros.
All right.
Thanks to them for sponsoring the show this week.
Okay.
Let's do a follow-up. So we got some Scribd fans emailing in, and we really asked two related questions, I guess. One is, what do you think of the original content-rich large idea, and then the Mueller's War as like, can you tell us anything about why they might pick that book? Let's take the most specific one first. The best theory I heard about this, and again, this is half-baked theories, which I appreciate. So
oh, yes, those are
in,
the best.
Was like, well, there's been so many Trump books this year that they think maybe people came to Scribd because the hold at their library for whatever was so long, but they could read Fury or listen to it. There's no hold list on Scribd. You could just listen to it.
Okay.
And they thought maybe some people were in it for those kinds of political books, and so another one that they could only get on Scribd might be a good hook to keep up with it.
That's not a bad half-baked theory.
It's plausible. Like it's connected to something that's new and different. So that one I thought was interesting. And then in terms of like excitement levels, I would say this is not interesting to the people who wrote to us about Scribd.
The people have declared this a nothing burger.
Yeah. I mean, even we said like, okay, so maybe if J.K. Rowling has a whatever, they're like, even that. And as some of it was, I want to read what I want to read. And unless it's something I really want to read myself, I don't think it would keep it into me. The other point, which I think was well taken, is there's something about this middle ground between a magazine article and a book that feels like itself is half baked. Like if it's an actual thing, why not just go make it a thing?
Oh,
like, why give me the leftovers or scraps or the yesterday's fish special and today's soup kind of situation?
I kind of disagree with that. I've read enough books that were too long where it was like, we got to make this thing book length, and so here are five extra chapters.
I think their thinking, which I can understand, is if it was even that good, they would make it too long. They're saying, are these things even not good enough to make long? Are they being expanded from a magazine article?
Got it.
Are they too long already, right? Mm-hmm. I take your point completely that there's a lot of books that you could read, especially in sort of the self-help, productivity, businessy kind of things. Like, all right, I get it. This could be 80 pages longer and skip all the anecdotes.
Yeah, I think I'm just trying to – I think I'm in the place of like the length of a book tells me not much about if it's going to be good or not. So I'm trying not to read too much into like that it's not an article or a book. It's an in-between thing.
Yeah, I think to use a different analogy is like this is sort of the freelance equivalent of like re-gifting. It's all right, and I can do this with it, and I wouldn't use it myself, but I don't know. I don't know if that's unfair, but that was the point taken. It's like, it's not a magazine article. It doesn't have that tightness and focus of a magazine article. It's also not a book. It's this other kind of thing in between. And since we don't know exactly what the motivations of the authors are, like maybe we would feel differently if Roxane Gay got a $100,000 advance for this thing. That would maybe signal that it's premium content, but since publishing doesn't talk about how much money it makes, we never know anything, and so anything could be garbage. But I don't. That was too much.
All the problems of publishing summed up in one sentence.
So I thought that was interesting that it was not going to be a deal breaker. And the point that kind of to connect a few dots was, you stay for Scribd for the breadth of the catalog, and one additional pebble on the beach doesn't make it a better beach. Which that makes sense to me. That makes sense to me. All right. So there's that.
All right.
You want to do the follow-up?
Yeah,
I want to do that next.
Exactly the follow-up, or at least on the road to the follow-up we were hoping to get on last week's story about the Washington Department of Corrections, which at the time had issued a new policy that blocked prisoners from receiving used books. There was a, I think, predictable public outcry about this new policy, and it appears now that the DOC is amending the policy. The secretary chair of the State Department of Corrections of Washington, his name is Stephen Sinclair, announced last week that it will ensure that prisoners are still able to receive used books. The original memo blocked used books through the mail over the stated issue of the potential of contraband coming in. And the Seattle nonprofit Books to Prisoners was one that we had been discussing there because they have been sending used books to correctional facilities for decades with no issues about contraband. And so they were raising some eyebrows about, is this really what's going on? So Sinclair really has just followed up saying that they're going to continue working with Books to Prisoners to adjust the policy. The quote is, we are going to ensure that we have processes in place that allow people to get used books. They won't all go through the Washington State Library as they don't have the resources. And that lack of resources is one of the reasons that Books to Prisoners exists and continues to try to, you know, provide access and then fight for ongoing access for prisoners. Books to Prisoners itself made a statement on Facebook. It looks like this is just from yesterday as we're recording the show, saying that they think that this is a good start, but that there are still policies which need to be negotiated, not just for Books to Prisoners in Seattle, but for all community groups that are sharing a mission of providing free used books to Washington prisoners. And there's a longer note from them that we'll have a link to in the show notes on their Facebook page, along with a link to a full memo about the updated policy. So especially if you're in the state of Washington and you're following this story, you can get a little bit more information, but happy to see that this pattern that we've seen in other places where prisons have issued or departments of correction have issued policies, the public does not like this. And there has been an outcry that so far typically has resulted in walking back the policy. Really happy to see that that pattern is continuing. Though, like, I obviously, ideally, we wouldn't be in this pattern at all because we wouldn't be seeing departments of correction and prisons trying to walk back access to books in the first place. So I really wonder if we're going to hit a point where we can stop having these stories. Like, will the prison people all start talking to each other and being like, hey, don't actually make this policy because it did not go well for us?
Yeah. I'm not sure if I can use their name because I know it's sensitive, but I'll err on the side of caution that someone who works in this field listened to our show last week and said, we asked the question, like, was there some sort of conference among people who work in prisons that said, you know, this is something we've got to pay attention to because we are, you know, we feel like we're seeing more of these stories than we have in the past. And this person said, we're wondering the same thing.
Interesting.
Who works on the nonprofit side, saying, like, so I guess there is some sort of uptick. Like, why they're not clear why this is happening either right now. So there's more to figure out. Was there a memo, you know, was some knowledge sharing saying, you know, this is something we need to crack down on because X, Y, or Z, or they're doing it for reasons of, like we speculated about, you know, it takes staff time to facilitate these programs. And if you're going to cut something, I can imagine it would be easy for a prison to say, you know, all this time we spend going through books or whatever, we could get rid of that. You know, I don't really want to do a generous reading, except people have reasons for doing things. We just don't know what they are and, like, why there's a confluence of these reasons happening all at the same time.
Yeah, it feels like there should be, excuse me, it feels like there really should be an explanation for why this wasn't a thing we saw much of, and then all of a sudden we're seeing several stories about it per year, and, like, where this pattern came from.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll have some other little birdies that have some ideas. Thank you to the listener who wrote in about that.
One other point that I was thinking about too is, you know, the internet and reporting and things catch on. So maybe they were and they weren't just getting picked up. You know, that's another piece of it. But another thing that occurred to me too is, like, I'm as guilty of this as anyone times 10, but, like, we tend not to think, many of us, of prisons and prisoners as a group we're interested in advocating for writ large. Mm-hmm. And so things that negatively affect their experience don't rise to the level of let's write a post about it and get a bunch of signatures. But since it's books, which we have, like, has it, we think of as in a romantical kind of a way of having inherent value, that right. one will take mm-hmm. care of. Like, notice we're not talking about the food conditions.
Right.
I have no idea what the food situation is. I'm guessing it's not awesome, but something about not letting nonprofits donate books to prisoners. I don't know. I just wanted to comment on that phenomenon as being maybe part of this. It's like, is the thing where are we actually caring about the prisoners here, or is it this idea of censoring and keeping books out? I don't know. I'm wondering about that dynamic and making myself a little uncomfortable, maybe usefully uncomfortable about
yeah,
that question.
I think that's usefully uncomfortable, and it does, I agree, go back to, at least in part, this notion or that we have about books being an obvious net good, and like always a net good, and also the sort of noble aspects of
right.
promoting books and reading. And so, like, to care about books and reading, to promote books and reading, to make sure books get to people because books are good and people should have books. It does feel like some of this could be more about literary activism than it is about activism for what mm-hmm. prisoners need. And I don't want to get into math about like which one of those kinds of activism is more important or more right. I think we can care about multiple things. But if we had to do the math about like what matters more, prisoners having nutritious food or prisoners having access to books, like I would find myself very usefully uncomfortable about the, I guess, clash in my values and what I was mm-hmm. publicly talking about. Cause I think I would have to come down on the side of like, we need to keep people alive and take care of their bodies and feed them healthy and nutritious food first. Like, this is a thing our bodies need before they need access to reading and dictionaries as the stated most frequent request. So that is, I think it's important to hang that lantern out there, not that it invalidates the literary activism of this and the importance of getting books to people who need access to books mm-hmm. and information. We all should have access to information, but it's not the only thing going on, and it really shouldn't be the biggest story, probably.
Or I don't even know. I mean, I don't even know where on the pecking order it would go, but like, and again, we work in books, so we see the world through the prism
right.
of books, so it's not surprising we're going to talk, but I did have a moment of wondering about like, it made the front page. I mean, Kelly's story that she wrote for us made the front page of Reddit. Mm-hmm. When was the last time something about prisoners' rights made the front page of Reddit? Maybe it makes it all the time and I don't see it. Maybe it does.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I'm guessing it doesn't, though. Mm-hmm. That's just my guess. So I wanted to mention that, too. So anyway, you might hear from more about this story from us. I don't want to give anything away, but there might be some more coming from us in a different venue soon. I think you don't even know about that yet.
But I have good guesses now.
Yeah. This is sort of a follow-on new piece of information that, speaking of things we didn't talk about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
This story came out a few days ago. This is a piece in The Verge, as always, link in the show notes, bookriot.com/listen. You can find them. The first AI-generated textbook was, released, printed. I don't know if it's just ebook only or what. It was made. It's available. You can get it.
For free.
And
you can download
get it
for
free. And it is an academic publisher named Springer Nature generated using machine learning. It is called Lithium Ion Batteries, a machine-generated summary of current research.
All right.
And it's, you know, I don't know that it's a page-turner necessarily. And as The Verge says, as the name suggests, it's a summary of peer-reviewed papers published on the topic in question. It has quotations, hyperlinks, generated reference content. Fascinating use case. This is one where, so summary of current research means the AI went through a bunch of research related to this topic and generated summaries that you can browse. And this is a very useful thing for researchers and scientists or academics. It could be about anything, I guess. It just so happens that this one is lithium ion batteries, where like, without having to go read all the papers, you can go and basically get the Cliff Notes version of them. And a machine did it. They didn't have to have humans go do all the reading and writing. They could go do it. And this, we know some news organizations do this for like local sports scores. Financial reporting, you know, where they can feed in the company's annual report plus their pros and, you know, spit out a 300-word thing that says how GE did last quarter. This seems to me a very useful use of AI, and you can make it free because you didn't pay $1 billion for a human to go do this, which a billion is an exaggeration, but this is a very time-consuming effort, and it's available, and it's kind of a, you know, with the autonomous vehicles, they talk about geofencing, so you can't go out of the side of the bounds of what it knows. It's a limited, constrained use case. I think this is really interesting. I hadn't thought about this kind of use case in research, but this seems to be exciting. This is the thing where it seems to be additive. Like, I don't think this is taking anyone's job, but it's giving us a new tool that we wouldn't have had without AI here. I'm very interested in this.
Yeah, I'm totally fascinated by this also, and a little bit like embarrassed that it didn't occur to me that AI would be a great way to move forward academic publishing and sort of moving forward the research in this way. This piece notes that just in the last 3 years, more than 53,000 research papers have been published on lithium ion batteries, which if you're a scientist working in that field, there's just no way that you can stay on top of all of that.
No.
And so if you can access AI generated summaries of those, you have a better chance of knowing sort of the full picture of what's going on in your field, which allows us to have new ideas sooner and like actually move research forward rather than like, you know, conducting an experiment that someone else has already conducted, but you don't know because it got published in one of those 53,000 pages or papers that you haven't read yet. Maybe you've only read, you know, 2,000 of them, or who knows, like how much, you can't do that much reading. We're producing so much more information now at such a high rate that applying AI, I think, to academic work like this is, it's really smart. And I think it can have huge benefits in allowing the humans who have, like, we still need humans for innovative thought. I don't think AI has gotten there yet of like, we don't have AI that's reading these 53,000 research papers and then suggesting to us what the next thing should be. We still need people for that. And having AI do the summary work and sort of like provide the top level view of a thing allows the humans who do the innovation to like to get there, I think, in a more interesting way, in a bigger picture way, in a faster way. Like, growth will continue to move because of this in ways that it can't if you have to try to read 53,000 papers or just be behind. Like, everyone is just perpetually not all the way caught up because the volume of information that's coming out is so vast. I think this is fascinating. I can't wait to, like, I'm not going to read this one about lithium ion batteries, but like, I was thinking about how, the first paper that Kahneman and Tversky wrote that like led to all the thinking fast and slow stuff and then led to the Nobel Prize that they won. Like, that one of those first papers has been cited like a floppity jillion times. And they talk about in either one of the books or an interview that I read with them how often it's cited. And you can search through academic journals to find like the number of citations for a thing. So it would be cool to have like an AI summary of all the different kinds of studies that have gone back and relied on that Kahneman and Tversky piece. You could do that. Like, what are the things that grew out of all of these sort of kernel turning point discoveries that we had would be really interesting too.
Yeah, I think the phrase here they use that I think is useful is automating drudgery, which is fascinating because, you know, the nightmare scenario about robots and AI, well, the nightmare one is Skynet and they want to eat our brains and all that stuff. The next one down, or a couple ones down, is they take all the jobs and sort of our economic system falls apart because only the people that own the AI can, you know, earn any money whatsoever. Like, your own labor doesn't even have any value, so you can't work and blah, blah, blah. Which I'm not enough an expert to say, but the thing that we tend not to think about in the nightmare scenarios around AI and robots is it's the work that's not being done because it's not worth it to be done. Even to pay someone to do it, we wouldn't pay someone to do it because it's not worth it to us, because it wouldn't generate enough revenue to pay for that person's labor. And that's this kind of work. I mean, it doesn't say here, but did this book take someone's job? It doesn't seem like it.
Mm-mm.
It's just, we could do this and create this different kind of object that in human time value is not worth making, but we're not using human time value and it has worth. It's just somewhere between nothing and where we have to pay someone to do it as a human. So that's interesting, though. You might notice here, and it's not perfect. There's still some garbled stuff that comes out. Like, so one phrase that I should shout out the name of the person in The Verge, James Vincent caught or was brought to his attention was, here's one phrase that is clearly, we're not all the way to the promised land of even spitting out sort of rote texts. That might consequence in substantially high emphasizes and henceforth cracking or delamination.
Henceforth cracking.
I mean, maybe if you know what's, you know, the cracking and delamination, maybe in context you could parse that. But just on its face, you could see that something got lost in, the robot got lost, and it's not human readable there. So there's still pieces here, but I thought this was, I don't know, one of these books is going to be a watershed moment, I think.
I think so, too.
I don't know if this is it, but maybe this is the one of the raindrops that goes into the watershed. I'm not sure, but this really opened my eyes to some interesting use cases I hadn't thought about before. That's not Lord of the Rings fan fiction, which has its use case, don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's do another sponsor. You want to pick up another one here?
Yes, I believe this one is me. Our next sponsor this week is Trust Exercise by Susan Choi. This is the new novel by Pulitzer Prize finalist. Trust Exercise is a story about the enduring aftermath of the events of adolescence and about the complexities of consent and coercion among teenagers and adults. Through a narrative twist, Trust Exercise raises questions about the reliability of memory and the accuracy of the stories we tell, and it considers the consequences of our memories and our stories across time. This is one of the most anticipated new books of the year. I have been hearing nothing but wonderful things about it. It seems like my entire Instagram feed was filled with people reading Trust Exercise over the last week. It's published by Henry Holt and available now wherever books are sold. So you can pick up Trust Exercise by Susan Choi at your bookseller of choice, or as always, click a handy link in our show notes. Thank you to them for sponsoring.
Speaking of potential watershed moments, I put this in the agenda a few weeks ago and we didn't get to it, so it's a little bit of old news, but I still think it's worth talking about, especially in the context of this show. It connects a few of our thoroughgoing, ongoing concerns. So Blackstone, well, no longer audio, Blackstone Publishing, which is the largest independent publisher of audiobooks, is partnering with the Story Factory to dramatically expand its presence. This is verbatim from a story at NBC29.com, link in the show notes, to expand its presence in the print and ebook market. Mm-hmm. So this is not, you know, print and text publishers adding more and more audiobooks. This is a counterflow. As a centerpiece of this partnership, Blackstone is assigning three authors that are New York Times bestsellers and Edgar Award winners who are PRH authors. They're all living PRH to join Blackstone, which in itself is super interesting. So the names, I don't know these names, which doesn't mean anything. Steve Hamilton, Reed Farrell Coleman, and Edgar Award-winning Meg Gardner. I don't know anything about genre. Well, I guess Edgar is mysteries, right? A couple of mysteries. I'm not sure about the other one. I think this is really interesting. And I guess I'll let you lead off. Do you think this is interesting? And then tell me why you think it's interesting.
I think it's interesting. Well, I think it's interesting on one level because we've been seeing so much growth with audio. Blackstone certainly has experience doing that. But audio is still a small portion of the market. So if you want your business to grow, you can either just keep growing audio, like pushing that ball up the hill, which it is growing, but still, or you can branch into formats that readers are consuming more. So print and ebook makes sense there. The poaching of the PRH authors is interesting. Like Blackstone, I think, has relationships with a lot of authors directly or with their agents directly because of some of the ways that like audiobooks get made when they're not made in-house by a publisher. So that stuff is like very complicated and probably more inside baseball than we want to go here. So I'm interested in that. But really, like, this piece sent me down a weird rabbit hole because in the third paragraph, it mentions that this deal was closed after months of negotiation between the CEO of Blackstone and Shane Salerno of the Story Factory, which represents all three authors. And I was like, what is the Story Factory? I've never heard of this. So I went Googling And Shane Salerno has a background in like in Hollywood entertainment stuff and is the agent for these writers. But the Story Factory is apparently like it's a thing that they kind of keep on the down low. Like if you Google Shane Salerno, the Story Factory, you get a Wikipedia page and a couple interviews that mention him and some like Hollywood reporter-ish type things. But there's not like a website for the agency, which is super unusual. Like, you know, mostly like literary agencies or talent agencies have websites that show the agents and talk about who they represent and like how you get them, but they don't have that. And it's intentional, I think, like they just sort of fly under the radar. But Salerno also represents Marcus Saeki, who had that really big, it was an Amazon,
that was with Amazon, right?
Amazon published book a couple of years ago. I think it was like a thriller. I can't remember. I remember seeing his name. I can picture the cover. I'm like, it's like standing in the bookstore right now. I can picture the cover and I think it's orange. I don't remember the title. But that, like, this is interesting to me that the way that Blackstone, you know, is sort of launching is with poached authors, but they're not like big recognizable names. Like, you know, they didn't poach like James Patterson from Hachette, but this deal with a guy / agency that seems to be like powerful and good at high profile deals and good at like making money for the people that he represents. Like the Marcus Saeki deal, I remember, was very big. Like that is interesting to me that that's how they've rolled out. I have no, like, I don't have any other information about it because I tried, but there's like, you can't find out much. If you are in publishing and you know things about the Story Factory, please hit us up. I think it's interesting. Like readers, we know, don't care about publishers. No. Like they don't care. They don't pay attention. Most readers don't know the difference between Riverhead and Algonquin. They're looking for the author's name that they recognize or the title of the book that someone has recommended to them or that their book club is reading or that they saw on the Today Show. Like, so on that end, if Blackstone gets good authors and publishes books that they do a good job putting money and publicity behind, I think they have a chance at this succeeding, and that they're working with an agent already who like knows how to get publicity for his authors. That seems smart because readers aren't going to be like, what is this Blackstone? Is this a new publisher? I don't know about that. You know, like there's, there's no risk on the consumer side, or there's no risk that your consumers like will side eye you because you're new in the market. Cause readers just are not paying attention. So I think that part is interesting to see. We don't see like the birth of a new publisher that often at this scale.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
The piece, I agree with a lot of that. The other piece that made me realize, like Blackstone, and you may know more about this than I do, but like historically Blackstone's business model is they make the audiobook edition, they license from other, you know, traditional publishers, let's not call them regular publishers, traditional publishers, to make the audiobook version of the books that the main publisher wasn't going to make for whatever reason. So like it's a side business, right? Mm-hmm. These are kind of the lead, and historically the audiobook version are kind of the leavings of the publishing industry. And so Blackstone's like, well, if we do a whole bunch of these and we're good at producing them and we can promote them, the publishers themselves don't want to do it. They've made a nice business for themselves out of this over time. But as audiobooks have become more lucrative, there's less incentive, or the publisher can extract more value out of keeping the audiobook rights in-house. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at it like Blackstone's, they need content. They got to produce audiobooks. Mm-hmm. And if Penguin Random House, to use the example from here, it's like, you know what, we're not gonna sell the audiobook rights to Blackstone for our books because we can get more of the pie. There's more pie and we can get more of it if we keep it themselves. And you can see a chain of events in which Blackstone is like, wait a minute, all these publishers are creating their own audiobooks directly. What's our business? So I wonder if this is not offensive. At first, I thought this was offensive. Like Blackstone's growing and, you know, they can do... The more I think about this, this looks to me like a defensive play. It's like, we got to have stuff to publish because we can see a future where all these publishers say, you know what? These are ours. There's plenty of money. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for us to give them away. So that's kind of where I'm coming down the other side.
I think that totally stands to reason. I'm feeling like we just lived right into our typical roles where I was like Googling gossip about a guy whose reputation precedes him, but he doesn't exist on the internet. And you were like, what is the business model?
What's the business model? Yeah, that's interesting. That's really funny.
You know, while also, we're talking,
also, not for nothing, Blackstone has the most intimidating name of all. It feels like it'd be.
It sounds like independent... Jason Bourne should work there.
Well, that's it's like a combination of Treadstone, which is the Bourne, Blackwater. And Blackwater. Yeah, it's Blackstone.
It does. If you gave people a blind test of like, what does a company named Blackstone produce?
Yeah.
Not in 20 guesses is someone going to be like audiobooks.
Yeah, they provide private security in Syria. That's what Blackstone does.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, speaking of audiobooks, our friends at Audible have to give out 12 million audiobooks for free to end a class action lawsuit, or a couple lawsuits actually, that accuse them of cheating users out of earned credits and violating gift card laws. They also have to pay $1.5 million in attorney fees, but like, you're Audible, so that's not much money.
Right.
But under the terms of the deal, 8.4 million users are going to be reimbursed for overdraft fees that they were charged when the company allegedly applied charges to a backup card or a debit card without authorization. The class action lawsuit's been going on for 18 months, and before it was reached, Audible twice attempted to have the claims dismissed. They are noting, this is from a website that gathers information about class action lawsuits. We'll have a link in the show notes. I can't remember what I came across this on at first, but Audible users are expressing approval of the settlement. And as part of the deal, Audible has agreed to revise and clarify its advertisements, its disclosures, and its terms. So if you are an Audible subscriber, I guess keep an eye out. You might be receiving some of these free credits. I noticed I got an email last week about an update in Audible's policy that credit, it used to be that your credits expired after 6 months, and now they are good for a year, I believe. And I'll have to go and double check, because a few months ago, Bob and I share an Audible account, and he discovered that his personal Amazon account also apparently had Audible credits that he didn't remember signing up for them. And we went back and were able to track that, like, this had been, like, he'd had an Audible account he was unaware of for like a year, and half of the credits had expired because he didn't know that they were there. And so the other half he needed to like use up quickly and then close that section. But we were like, how did this happen? We've never purchased Audible memberships through this. We couldn't find receipts or anything. So perhaps I am, you know, unwittingly part of
justice for Bob.
Now he can listen to more Patrick O'Brien audiobooks.
Tall ships.
While sitting on a deck of a beach house overlooking the ocean. Justice for Bob. He'll be so pleased.
Hashtag justice for Bob. I don't know what else to say about this. If you would have asked me, do I know how long my credits last? I wouldn't, because I scoop them up pretty quick. 6 months at first blush, I would have been like, that seems wrong. That they expire after 6 months. We're modern people, and gift cards usually either they last indefinitely or a year seems to me a minimum, what I've seen from gift cards in the past. Not for nothing, subscription companies at all, part of their business model is what they call breakage. Or is it breakage or slippage? It's something where it sounds like you should do something to your hip, but it's actually part of their business model, where they know some percentage of the gift cards are never going to be used. They know some percentage of the credits will expire over time, and it's built into the business model. Now, is that wrong? Is that just human nature? I don't know. But it sounds to me like Audible was trying to move up the timeline in their favor of what people sometimes do. I don't know what. Is it reason? Forever seems unreasonable, right? That a company's going to keep on to them forever. On the other hand, 6 months is too short. I feel like a year sounds right to me.
Yeah,
that seems,
I think,
fair.
That's fair.
If you're not going to use your credit in a year, maybe cancel your account. You know, that's okay. You can do that.
And you can, like, with Audible, you own the books even if you cancel your Audible subscription. So you could, like what Bob did, was just literally use his 6 credits that were remaining to buy 6 Patrick O'Brien audiobooks, download them, and then close that Audible subscription. So, like, you still have access to that. You haven't actually lost those books. Like, I think having the credits expire, because it doesn't mean that you have to listen to the books on a certain time frame, makes sense. And like, all gift cards have some, or I think most gift cards have some kind of expiration built in where either they go completely dead after a certain date or they erode over time. Like I received, I think it was a Visa gift card that I received as a gift, and it had a note on it that it was like after, I think after 2 years, it unused values deplete by like $2 per month or per year or something. Like there were terms on it of if you don't use all of this within 2 years, you won't have access to all of it after 2 years. It will like gradually deplete itself.
And this is real insider baseball, but we also happen to know that there's also an accounting reason that the business needs to do this. This is not just about taking your money, right? Because the way gift cards work for a lot of people especially is like, you, if you buy the gift card to a Barnes & Noble, let's use a third party here, for $100 and you give it to your mom or your dad or your sister or whatever, Barnes & Noble has to realize that as a debit. They still owe that, right? They take your money, but they still owe $100 in goods and services, and so they've got to keep that on their books until it's charged. They can't realize the money until it's actually been charged, but then they have the cash, and you can get it. You could imagine getting this in a situation where it's like, we actually owe more in gift cards than we have in cash because there's decades of gift. So maybe this is how it happens. This is how you become Daddy Warbucks. You do business and you're like, well, I can see it from the company's point of view, but there is a weird accounting thing that has to be dealt with. So,
oh yeah, probably some accountant at Audible was like, we're going to have an issue if these credits just sit there forever. Yeah. So somebody figure out how to move these credits.
Right. And they're like, 6 months good? Sure. Why not? Yeah. I mean, it could be something as simple as that. Mm-hmm. What's not clear to me here, it says they're going to give out 12 million free audiobooks as a result of this. How do you know? I guess you're going to get will you get a credit in your account? Because do you get this like every now and again? We'll get like a thing in the mail. Yeah. Like you may have $4 in class action settlement money from, you know, Daddy Warbucks Gas and Electrical.
Right. There were ebook settlements a couple years ago. And
Apple.
And I feel I got one from Barnes & Noble too, where I got an email that was like, you're going to receive, you know, it was like $1.25 in your Nook account. So I would expect it would happen that way, like since it's a digital subscription, that you would get some notification of like, hey, you got an extra credit in your account in Audible as a response to this thing. Here we are. Or like, I think it came as a big form letter in email of like, you will soon see an extra credit applied as a result of this class action, whatever. Be interesting.
Let us know if you get one.
Yeah.
Podcast at bookriot.com.
Justice for Bob.
Justice for Bob. Yeah. Please put justice for Bob in the subject line of the email, please.
You know, it's been a while since Bob had a cameo. So.
Very exciting. Big day for Bob.
You want to hit us with our last
Let's do our
sponsor.
Last sponsor. We got potpourri of interesting stuff. This week's episode is sponsored by Once and Future by Amy Rose Capetta and Corey McCarthy. Ari Helix has been chased her entire life, a fugitive refugee in territory controlled by the evil Mercer Corporation. You know their gift cards expire after 6 months, the Mercer Corporation. They're that bad. Ari has always had to hide who she is until she crash lands into old Earth, pulls a magic sword from its ancient resting place, and becomes the 42nd reincarnation of King Arthur. Then she meets Merlin, of course, because Merlin's he comes a running every time the sword gets pulled, who has aged backwards over the centuries into a teenager, and together they must break the curse that keeps Arthur coming back. Their quest? Defeat the cruel, oppressive government and bring peace, inequality to all humankind. No pressure. Once in Future is King Arthur as you've never imagined, a bold, sizzling, game-changing YA epic that retells the popular legend with Once in Future King as a teenage girl, and she has a universe to say. Amy Rose Capetta and Corey McCarthy are real-life romantic partners and members of the LGBTQ+ community. Couldn't be more excited to share this story, one that showcases queer heroes on the page and the grand scale. So that's Once in Future by Amy Rose Capetta and Corey McCarthy. Thanks to them for sponsoring this show.
There is a classic story that was due for some
seriously
time. I am ready to read this book.
And
you know what? It'll probably get challenged.
Will get challenged.
Because LGBTQ books often get challenged, as we know.
Yep.
So for as many years as we have done this show, we have reported on the American Library Association's list of the most frequently challenged books. And the list is out for 2018. They did top 11 this year. Maybe as an interesting top line number to have, the ALA Office for Intellectual Freedom tracked 347 challenges to library, school, and university materials and services in 2018. And of the 483 books that were challenged and banned, here are the top 11. So I can't decide if I think that 347 is high or low. Like, we definitely don't hear about all of these because we don't even have a story every week on this show about what's going on there. That's what, like, 7 per state roughly in a year? That seems like a lot. That's a lot. This should not
almost
be happening.
One a day? Almost one a day?
Oh, yeah, when you put it that way. This should, no, that's too high.
Quick question about that, because I had a similar thought. What crosses the challenge threshold? Is it a single letter from a parent? Like, does it get recorded? I don't know. That I might imagine as being way more, but maybe that's not the definition of a quote-unquote challenge.
We should ask Kelly. Kelly Jensen on staff is a former librarian, so we should ask her. And if you are a librarian and you know these things, feel free to email us about how that works. I think that's a great, like, how do you define challenge is a great question for this.
Wait, are you saying that I am asking about more specificity and definition? That's a shock.
You know, just get ready, Jeff, because you're going to want to soak this in.
Okay.
I think this might be a distinction that people actually do care about.
Justice for Bob.
Justice for Bob. So maybe someday we'll have justice for Jeff, but I'm going to need to, like, really prepare for that. So in order, here in the top 11, George by Alex Gino. We've seen this on the list before. It was, you can see the reasons on this list that the ALA provides that the book was challenged. It was banned, it was challenged, and it was relocated in different places because it was believed to encourage children to clear their browser history. Man, that is a specific complaint. And change their bodies using hormones, and for mentioning, quote, dirty magazines, for describing male anatomy, quote, creating confusion, and just for including a transgender character, because that's where people live. The book A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo by Jill Twiss, which was produced by the John Oliver team, is number 2 on this list. It was also banned and challenged for including LGBTQIA content. Captain Underpants is here. Also joining Captain Underpants for children's books that are challenged is the Skippy John Jones series, which it was challenged for depicting stereotypes of Mexican culture. And we very rarely actually see books make this list for, like, good reasons. But a children's book written by a white person that is about a chihuahua who does do some things that are maybe not awesome stereotypes of Mexican culture.
Okay.
Like, we might actually be due for a conversation about Skippy John Jones. Not that it should be challenged and banned places, but, like, a discussion about that content might be useful. The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas was banned and challenged because it was deemed anti-cop. Drama by Raina Telgemeier was banned and challenged for LGBTQIA characters and themes. 13 Reasons Why by Jay Asher. This One Summer by Mariko Tamaki, challenged for profanity, sexual references, and certain illustrations. That's a queer story as well. Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie, longtime resident on this list. This Day in June by Gail Pittman, illustrated by Christina Litton, was challenged and burned for including LGBTQIA content. And Two Boys Kissing by David Levithan was challenged and burned for including LGBTQIA content. And now I'm remembering the story. There was that piece about the guy who was burning public library books, remember? And I wonder if
that
this
must
is
have
that
been
guy
meant.
From Iowa, I believe. So notably, more than half of the books on the list were the objection to them is connected to the fact that there aren't, it's not about straight people. And that's just a theme that persists, that is troubling. I think that's really that's like sort of the top line theme of this list for the last several years, is that people are objecting to things about the gay community, the queer community, and to this notion that, like, telling a story about a trans character will confuse children about who they are themselves. It is ridiculous. And, like, I don't know if it's technically ironic, so you'll have to tell me that the book that John Oliver produced to make fun of Mike Pence for being anti-gay is a children's book about a gay bunny, and that book itself got challenged for being about gay content.
I'm not
is
sure
that
it's ironic?
Ironic?
It's not technically ironic, but we'll let it stand just for it. So
it's like ironic adjacent, I guess.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I mean, by my count, 6 of these 11 books, as you went through them, were challenged in large part because of LGBTQ plus related reasons.
Yeah.
Over time, the number of challenges, last year there were 354, so fewer challenges this year. But the year before that, there were only 323. The year before that, only 275. In 2014, 311. The high watermark of late came in 2012, of 464 challenges recorded by the Office of Intellectual Freedom. 460 in 2009, 513 in 2008.
Hoo boy.
546 in 2006. So about 10 years ago, there was almost, you know, 50% more challenges, 40 to 50% more. So take that for something. I'm not sure what to say about it, because I was like, are there more of these or fewer of these? There's some lumpiness to it, but it sounds like 10 years ago, we had a real spike in challenges.
Yeah,
I don't know why.
Looking at the list of the top 10 for 2008, none of them are still on this top list of banned and challenged books. We've got And Tango Makes Three, His Dark Materials, a whole series by Lauren Miracle, Scary Stories by Alvin Schwartz, Bless Me Ultima, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which people have been mad about that book for decades now, I guess. The Gossip Girl series, something called Uncle Bobby's Wedding, The Kite Runner, and Flashcards of My Life by Charisse Miracle Harper. And the reasons there, like, are there's some anti-ethnic things listed as a reason. Religious viewpoint is listed as a reason. So it's interesting to think back, like, where we were in 2008 as a culture, and what was happening sociologically and politically, the things people cared about. There's a lot of objection here to, like, this isn't religious, and, like, presentations of just homosexuality. Like, And Tango Makes Three is about a gay penguin couple, and people were super upset about that. So it has, we have evolved in the last 10 years that, like, we're not upset now about the existence of necessarily gay people, but, like, oh, the more complete spectrum is upsetting now. Like, it's still a problem that people are upset about this, but we are moving, I think, in the discussion.
It does look like the correlation to the spike where we're in the 500s for challenges did correspond, because And Tango Makes Three was the number one challenge book from 2006 to 2010. And I remember that at the time, that was a big deal. This was about the penguins, the gay penguins in the New York Zoo. Yep. There's even a Parks and Rec episode that's inspired by that, right?
So, like, she marries the
penguins. I wonder if it alone accounted for the additional challenges above and beyond sort of what the drumbeat seems to be.
That book was really a flashpoint, I remember.
It's so cute. It's so adorable. Adorable. And they try to use a rock as an egg. Oh my God, I'm going to cry just thinking about it.
And it's like, I think because it's a picture book and it's geared to, like, the smallest children, people got very upset about, like, what are you teaching the kids? Where I think that's some of what's going on with these objections to George by Alex Gino is it's middle grade, and people who are upset about these kinds of things are like, well, you're putting that content in front of, like, young kids and they don't know. Like, what if it were a picture book about a transgender character? That would, we'd probably be seeing even more challenges for it. You know, because we are in the years of Me Too, this is the first year that I think I've had, like, a complicated relationship with a couple of the books on the list, where I want to be very clear that I'm not for banning books ever. We've got 13 Reasons Why by Jay Asher here, and The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie. Alexie, who has acknowledged at least some of the allegations made against him. Jay Asher is currently suing people who made allegations against him, where, like, booksellers are taking books by these authors off their shelves. Teachers and librarians are removing these books from syllabi. I really liked The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, but I'm not recommending that book to people anymore because I don't want to put money in Sherman Alexie's pocket. So I'm having a discussion with myself about, like, that this presents an interesting opportunity to still fight for the principle of, you know, not banning literature, but having nuance to the discussion about, like, we also don't have to promote literature that's by people whose actions we object to. I had to sit with that for a little bit. It's complicated.
That's tricky. I'm not sure what else there is to say there. Link in the show notes.
Yeah.
If the historical data is interesting, that it's not really durable over time. It is interesting to see, oh, people are worried about that book, like what's new. But then people forget. People forget. You know, probably, I wonder, here would be an interesting stat. How many of those libraries or schools that had an Entango Makes 3 challenged has a copy of Entango Makes 3 in the library right now?
Yeah. You know, going back, the oldest list that's on this page we can just scroll right back to is from 2001, and it's dominated, so like almost 20 years ago, it's dominated by Harry Potter and then like
not surprised.
And then classics of school syllabi, like Of Mice and Men, The Chocolate War, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Catcher in the Rye, Go Ask Alice, Fallen Angels are the big ones on here that I've seen on syllabi that I read in school. And then also something called Summer of My German Soldier, Alice just by Phyllis Reynolds Naylor, and Blood and Chocolate by Annette Curtis Claus. And those that aren't like big titles that we know about from school lists, we haven't heard about in years. Like I have never heard of Blood and Chocolate in my.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Rebecca.
Right. But like 20 years ago, we were upset about things that we'd been teaching for decades.
I'm wondering if what's happened is those are like more high school books, right? Like books you'd read in high school. I wonder as culture around books and culture writ large has become in aggregate, let's say, more progressive. I think that's true over time, especially in the last 15 years. If that's true, don't at me if you disagree. You can disagree. That's fine. I could be wrong. We've moved from where do people who challenge books like this feel more comfortable challenging a book? And kind of like we said with Entango Makes 3 or George by Alex Gino, they're more comfortable. They feel like they might have more success maybe challenging books for younger and younger kids. Cause we are, I think rightly writ large, more protective of younger kids. Yeah. Right. So that's the battle lines have moved from high school, like sex in high school books, to say you're going to challenge a book for that kids in high school reading because it has sex in it, now seems almost laughable. I think some of this other stuff is laughable too, but it's laughable to a higher number of people now than say books about being trans. You can get more people on your side wrongly, I think. May your efforts fail.
Yeah, and these are
about George being, you know, for fourth graders. That's just where the battle line might be.
I think you're right. There's a real, like, think of the children
aspect
to this. And looking now at this list of 11 for the year, they're all books for people who aren't adults. Like, there is not a single title on this list that's written for adults. George's Middle Grade, A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo is a children's book. Captain Underpants is a kids series. The Hate U Give is YA. Drama is a YA graphic novel. 13 Reasons Why is YA. This One Summer is a YA graphic novel. Skippy John is picture books. Absolutely True Diary is YA. This Day in June is a kid's book. Two Boys Kissing is YA. And so there's a real, like, catch them before you can influence them too much kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
You know, it does. We talk about it every year, but that people get upset about these things points back to, like, that they do recognize that books and reading are powerful. They just don't understand how it works. That a book won't turn you gay. And then even if it could, that would be fine.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Or they're right. I mean, or they're right that it can normalize things that people don't want to be normalized. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point for many of these writers is to normalize things that we believe are on the progressive side of things that we believe are normal and should be normalized. But like, if you're not trans, reading George is not going to make you trans.
Right.
If you are trans and you're a kid and you have feelings that you haven't found language for, this book might give you language for that. And that's powerful. But folks who think like this book is going to turn my child trans, like just fundamentally don't understand.
Yeah. And that bans, I mean, you put the liquor behind the cabinet with a lock, makes the liquor more attractive. I mean, there's that other sort of Streisand effect thing that goes on too. Right. It'd be fascinating to hear from people who lived in a community where books were banned. Could they get them? Did they think about it? Was it a thing? Because there is that, we've talked about it before, where these people that write a letter to their, you know, local elementary school library, and then suddenly there's a piece on Bustle or somewhere about it. They're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Now everyone's talking about George, which is an amazing book. I was just thinking about, I was in the kids section of my local library the other day, and I was like, it was out and it was a staff pick. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. And when I was a kid, that just would not have happened. I lived in a a college town in the Midwest, but like even that, the book didn't exist for starters. But even if it had, I don't think it would be on its own like cover out display with a staff recommendation under it.
Hmm.
That was heartening. It's disheartening to see it challenged, but it's only challenged because it exists.
Maybe it exists is a huge thing.
Yeah. So that's if you've got more feedback progress. And you know more things about how this works, we're always interested in
what constitutes a challenge.
Yeah. Or if you're a librarian that's been through this, how it works before, podcast@bookriot.com. We can also keep you anonymous for sure. I know I don't want anyone saying something that they want to say, but won't say it because they're afraid of their name getting out there or something. That's our show.
Yes.
Podcast@bookriot.com for feedback. If you get an Audible credit, you know more about how the logistics, but also the realities of challenges and book bannings in libraries and schools. Recommendations. I have a few. I need to start the doc so I can start looking at it, but I have a few recommendations so far. Podcast@bookriot.com for a mom, dad, grad, yourself, gift, whatever. We tend to do it around this time of year to help people buy books for people that need gifts, but also we like to do it a couple times a year, and this is a good excuse to do it. Show notes, bookriot.com/listen. We'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one.